Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Julian Thomas. Welcome to the Wheeler Centre and Media Policy Makers and Shakers, What Can Government Do? A special session of our new news events here. A couple of things to start with. First of all, I'd like to make an acknowledgement of the traditional owners of this land, the Kulin Nation, a place now known by its European name of Melbourne. I'd like to acknowledge also the tradition, their elders past and present. I'd like to acknowledge the sponsors and organisers of this event, the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne and my own institution, Swinburne University of Technology. I think the role of universities in these kinds of events tells us something about the changing ecosystem of independent journalism in Australia. Just a reminder also, before we begin, about the hashtag for this event, newnews_AU. So please follow that. Not long ago, the media in Australia was convulsed by the Finkelstein and Convergence reviews, by proposals to introduce new regulatory structures for the press and to extend the reach of media policy into the domain of the internet. Those proposals were not enacted in the form they were intended. But is there unfinished business around media policy in Australia, and especially in terms of its impact on journalism, independent journalism's journalism, its prospects and problems? Now, to help us address these issues today, we're very lucky to have a remarkable panel of distinguished makers and shakers with us. So on our panel this afternoon, on my far left, Paul Fletcher, the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister for Communications and Member for Bradfield in Sydney's northern suburbs. Paul is the author of Wired Brown Land, Telstra's Battle for Broadband, published by New South in 2009. Taught by the renowned Columbia media economist Ellie Noem, a senior advisor to the former Minister Richard Alston in the Howard government, and a long-serving executive at Optus, Paul brings a very deep knowledge of communications policy and deep experience of the politics of policy in Australia. Jason Clare, in the middle, Shadow Minister for Communications and the Member for Blaxland, for those of you with memories, an electorate held by a very enthusiastic media policy maker and breaker in the past. Jason was Minister for Home Affairs and Minister for Justice, among other roles in the Gillard and Rudd governments. He's been an executive working for Transurban and an advisor to former New South Wales Premier Bob Carr. To Jason's left, Senator Scott Ludlam, Green Senator for Western Australia, and the Green spokesperson on media and communications, among many other areas. Scott really covers an incredible portfolio. He's well known as a technically savvy advocate for media diversity and plurality, and as a critic of this and the former government's policies on mandatory data retention, internet surveillance and related issues. He brings a distinctive and unusually well-informed voice on those matters to Parliament. And on my left, Malcolm Long, someone who's made a remarkable contribution to public service broadcasting, media and communications policy, and Australia's screen industries over many years. Among many senior roles, Malcolm's a former Managing Director of SBS and Deputy Managing Director of the ABC. He was Executive Director of the Australian Film, Television and Radio School, and he's now Chairman of the Australian Centre for Broadband Innovation. He was one of the architects of the former government's Convergence Review, which emphasised the need to update regulatory and policy structures to reflect the realities of the contemporary media landscape, and then set out a way to do so. So that's our panel for this morning. Thank you and welcome. Now, what's going to happen is that each of our panellists is going to have a chance to say a few words, their response to these issues and problems. I'll probably ask a few questions at that point, but I'd like to open it up to you as soon as I can. So we'll begin with you, Paul, if you can give us your view on this.
Well, thank you, Julian. It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's a particular pleasure to be on the left of Scott Ludlam for once. look, as the person who speaks first, I'm able to make the most obvious points. And the obvious point is that this is a sector facing enormous change because of technology driving changes in the economics of businesses in the media sector, and in turn being responded to by changes in consumer behaviour. And so, as an obvious proposition, the arrival of the internet has totally disrupted this industry, and we've seen that placing great pressure on traditional media outlets, broadcast television, newspapers and so on, while a whole new class of outlets has emerged. And that reflects the changing economics. So the old economic model has been under great pressure. The classifieds, which were the rivers of gold, have effectively largely gone. At the same time, new models are emerging, and we would all have our own particular examples. One that I think is very interesting is Mamma Mia, and the way that they've built an audience online targeting particularly women, and using the capacity of the internet to be quite specific in the segments they target and adjusting their content to meet the particular appetite of their audience. And I think the other thing that is interesting is the way that consumers have changed their behaviour in response to what's being offered. One of the points that Malcolm Turnbull often makes is that while the newspaper business model is under great pressure, in fact, the appetite for what newspapers and media businesses generally are generating is greater than ever. And the Department of Communications' recent paper on media ownership and regulatory options there cites some interesting statistics that the Sydney Morning Herald had users for the print version on average in 2013 of 539,000, the online version, smh.com.au, 1.135 million. In other words, very strong demand for the product being delivered in a range of different ways. The big challenge is that the economics have fundamentally transformed. So, very briefly, what can industry participants do? And there's an enormous amount of innovation, but clearly adapting, responding, seizing the new opportunities. And in particular, it seems to me that in a world where, as we hear, everybody's a citizen journalist, everybody can be a content producer, the quality of the content is obviously better than ever, or more important than ever, I should say, in the traditional disciplines of writing, editing, curating, albeit across different media, become, it seems to me, more important than ever. Then lastly, what can government do? I guess the priorities you're seeing from the Abbott government and from Malcolm Turnbull as Communications Minister are firstly, and very distinctively compared to the previous government, a focus on reducing regulation, seeking to reduce the burden of red tape, including a lot of red tape that's been there for a long time, premised on TV, radio, etc., being highly profitable, reporting burdens and all kinds of detailed regulatory burdens that we're seeking to reduce and lift. We have clearly said that in terms of questions about media ownership restrictions, for example, we want to achieve a level of consensus amongst stakeholders before proceeding with reform initiatives, but there's clearly an appetite there. A lot of work on managing critical resources, particularly spectrum, which is an ever more important resource underpinning the delivery of content wirelessly. The commercial value of that and the social value of that is enormous. And also, as is well known, and as I have no doubt will become a topic of conversation later in this session, seeking greater efficiency from the public broadcasters, but a very clear focus, particularly from Malcolm Turnbull as Communications Minister, on efficiencies in the back office, rather than taking, as he's called it, the easy option of cutting high-profile programs. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Paul. Jason, you've got a right of reply.
Might become a topic of discussion right now.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thanks very much for the invitation to be here. I was thinking on the plane down from Sydney today, talking to a group of people who are journalists and potential journalists just how much has happened in this sector in the last 12 months. Seen illustrated how dangerous the role of a journalist can be, best illustrated by the murder of James Foley and what's happened to Peter Gresta in Egypt, but also how insecure the sector is. Job losses in Fairfax, 10 and ABC and potentially SBS, but also how important the role of a journalist is. Best captured perhaps by the work of Joanne McCarthy, one journalist in a regional newspaper whose work and courage led to a Royal Commission, which is changing the lives of people right around the country. And when Joanne won the Gold Walkley last November, she made this fantastic speech up in Brisbane and told the story that she didn't want to be a journalist originally. She wanted to be a librarian, and she only became a journalist because her boyfriend wanted her to stay in town and work at the Gosford Star. She went to the Royal Commission and heard the evidence that was given there, and she walked out of the Royal Commission with a tear in her eye, and she said, "The work I do is good and the work I do matters." And that's a message I'd want to pass on to people in this room. Thank you for doing the work that you're doing or that you're proposing to do. It really does matter. Compared to the work journalists do, the role of government in this space is a little bit more prosaic. As Paul made the point, government plays a role in creating the legislative framework, be that for the ownership of media companies or content or spectrum. It also plays a role in oversight through organisations like ACMA, as well as funding national public broadcasters, in our case, the ABC and SBS. In relation to the first two, I think it's well known this is a well-trodden minefield and the government's welcome to it. Earlier this year, we were told this was a priority. It now seems like it's on the back burner, and Paul's made the point the government's looking for consensus. It's not there at the moment. That might explain why nothing's happened. The point I would make here is that if the government is putting together policy here, it needs to do it and present it to the sector and the public as a job lot. You need to, from an opposition's point of view, we want to see what reforms the government is proposing, not just in the areas of ownership, but also in the area of sports broadcasting, anti-siphoning, as well as licence fees or retransmission fees. It's a bit of an ecosystem, this part of public policy, and one part can impact the other. In relation to public broadcasting, I think the government has breached the faith that the public put in it the night before the election. Night before the election, Tony Abbott said there'd be no cuts to the ABC and there'd be no cuts to SBS. But that's exactly what has happened, and we expect there'll be more cuts. There were cuts in the budget of more than $200 million. And Malcolm Turnbull has said expect substantial more savings to come. So in the space of just over 12 months, we've gone from no cuts to ABC and SBS to substantial cuts. And I think that's a serious breach of faith. Whilst Paul and Malcolm say that will only affect the back office, I think we are yet to see whether that is true or not. The potential is that it will affect content, that it will also affect journalism and the work that the journalists do at our national public broadcasters.
Thanks, Jason. Scott.
Oh, good morning. It's really lovely to be here, and just like to acknowledge our former parliamentary colleague, Rob Oakeshott, sitting up in the audience. You're missed, mate. You come back anytime. So I want to go back to the premise of the question and just really briefly sketch what happened, that the former government went through many years reviewing the shape of future media markets and what role, if any, the government should take in press regulation. So partly through the Finkelstein review, which is maybe more controversial because that went directly to what role does the state have in mediating between media organisations and their audiences, and the Convergence review, which took a more big picture approach to, well, what the hell do we do with, as all other speakers have acknowledged, the mainstream media, if you like, is under significant stress. The internet is extremely disruptive. Audiences are behaving in different ways. So, you know, what role can the government play in that environment of technological convergence where the internet's just gradually swallowing up one platform after another? So what we ended up with was this kind of many years of review, very careful review, evidence-based review, recommendations, reports, and then this bizarre attempt to shotgun a small, quite moderate, as far as we were concerned, subset, kind of a grab bag of what looked like it might be politically plausible, through Parliament in a massive hurry, if you can remember the kind of fevered environment in which the attempt was made to get a moderate subset of these reforms through the Parliament. And what happened, I think the word you used at the outset was convulsed, was the media proprietors went to war, and it was quite a thing. Set the editorial pages alight, stormed Canberra, furious front page after front page, Stephen Conroy dressed up as a Nazi. I mean, you remember full-on campaigning in defence of what the proprietors put into the public domain as the interests of a free press. And what we were looking at was a moderate, in my view, moderate expansion of the Press Council's powers to give readers or people who'd been attacked in the media partly some kind of right of reply and right of redress, and a public interest test on further consolidation of media interest. And that, I think, was the real catch. I don't think that convulsion was about press freedom at all. I think it was seen as an attack on the commercial health of the industry, or an attack on the commercial interests of the big media organisations to be able to continue to concentrate, consolidate, merge, acquire each other. And that was what the threat was. I don't think there was any material threat to press freedom, but nonetheless, the case was made, front page after front page, and the reforms were dropped. The blowtorch was put onto the crossbenches. The opposition thundered, that they would, you know, stand staunch in defence of the rights of the press, and everything kind of fell apart. So fast forward 2 years, because I want to contrast that behaviour and that campaign with what's just happened. We just criminalised national security reporting. A bill amending the ASIO Act passed the Parliament only last week, that effectively criminalises the reporting of certain categories of ASIO investigation permanently. You can do 10 years' time for reporting on the existence of a particular kind of secret operation, even if it's a complete stuff-up. And as Mr. Brett Walker SC has pointed out, if ASIO accidentally kills somebody, pretty bloody unlikely, let's face it, but in the event of something going horribly wrong, it will be impossible in perpetuity to report on the existence of that investigation. And you, as journalists, could be jailed for 10 years for reporting on it. I could be jailed for sharing your report on Facebook. So maybe you'll all end up getting prosecuted. I think it's more likely your stories will just be legaled out of existence and you won't get to publish them in the first place. A mandatory data retention regime, which has not yet passed the Parliament, completely circumvents Shield law protections. If we can simply, without a single warrant, track your mobile phone around the landscape and know exactly who you're talking to and who your sources are, forget it. The protections embedded in Commonwealth law, Shield laws that protect you and your work, are circumvented and practically worthless. And so what did we see by way of campaign from those same media proprietors that thundered into Canberra 2 years ago was stuff all, nothing. A few great journalists, a handful of people actually wrote up good stories beforehand, and there's a wave of regret reported on after the bills passed the Parliament and it was too late. But because, in my view, these changes to the ASIO Act and the mandatory data retention that's coming down the line don't really affect the business model or the commercial prospects of the big media companies, they sure as hell didn't storm into Canberra demanding that Parliament pull its head in and stop attacking press freedom. But there's a real attack on press freedom as far as I'm concerned. I do something that I've never done before, ever, in any public forum, ever, is quote Greg Sheridan. Here's what he said in a... You know, don't agree with everything that this guy says, obviously, but he says Section 35P of the National Security Legislation Amendment Bill, it's the ASIO bill, is a terrible piece of legislation that fundamentally alters the balance of power between the media and the government. Keep in mind, he writes this after the damn thing has passed the Parliament. Anyway, he says, in doing this, it seriously weakens our democracy and will ultimately weaken, in quite practical ways, our security. The Abbott government was wrong to propose it and the Shorten opposition wrong to support it. George Brandis and Mark Dreyfus should hang their heads in shame. It's an actual attack on press freedom, and we didn't see editorial after editorial condemning it, and that article, unfortunately, came a little too late. So I'm getting the wind-up. I could go on about this all day in case you hadn't noticed. We'll pick it up in the Q&A.
Thank you, Scott. Good to finish on the words of Greg Sheridan there. Malcolm, you've got the chance to come in and bring your non-partisan, non-political position to
totally
bear.
Non-partisan, I can assure you of that. Well, good morning, everyone. And I think that is my role, perhaps, to a bit of history, because I was involved in the convergence of review. One of the things government can do in this area is to have a review of what there is and some thinking about what might be. And we might argue later about big bang reform versus incremental reform and the strengths and weaknesses. But just quickly, a few ideas that came out of the convergence review, a very complex and detailed piece of work, which didn't get much run at the time for the reasons that have been mentioned, but which I think bear on this question of journalism and the quality of the media content we get. The first thing we came to was the fact that Australian media was wildly over-regulated. There was a real need for serious deregulation. And if you ever get to read the Convergence Review, I think you'll see that it is a very deregulatory document. It basically argued that you start with the proposition of why regulate. We took the proposition as our basic one that all Australians should have the freedom to communicate and on any platform. We didn't use the word right, we used the word freedom, because the politicians in this audience will know that once you start giving Australian rights, as distinct from freedoms, all sorts of constitutional and other complexities happen. But Australians should have the freedom to communicate on any platform. Now that's important, because the more people communicate, the better the quality of the content that's generated. So that's one tick for better journalism and better content. Secondly, we took the view that in this area, there was a need to think again about the shape of organisations that might require regulation. At the moment, they're siloed. We regulate television stations, radio stations, and to a degree, newspapers. And we virtually don't regulate in a significant way online organisations. We took the view that this was a suffocating, difficult environment for innovation to happen, when the truth is all media content and journalistic organisations are now on many platforms. And I would argue one of the problems of the people who talk about propping up newspapers through public funding and so on is that, in a sense, that's not the point. The point is that good journalistic organisations will need the freedom to move across platforms and make those that work for them into good content. And the key is to liberate these organisations, whether they're new media organisations that need to have light regulation or large, powerful media organisations that they themselves are wallowing through the various business models they can use, there needs to be much more freedom in people being able to build a business model that will work and will create great content. So which of these players do you regulate? And the ACMA did a fantastic piece of work in their Digital Australians survey some years ago, where they asked Australians about this question: what do you think about regulation on separate platforms and so on? And a really stunning and interesting notion came out. And the notion was, we Australians know that user-generated content and content by difficult websites that come from other countries, content by young startups in Australia, are going to be uncomfortable and causes some problems. But we're prepared to cop that because of the freedom and opportunity that the new environment delivers. We don't want regulation on those kind of players. But for those really big players, new or traditional, that focus on Australian audiences, that make lots of money out of Australian audiences, and that have big Australian audiences, we believe they need to carry a bit of the burden of acting appropriately, because they have so much influence and because they are doing well out of us, the citizens. And this kind of brings onto its side the old silo model, the notion being that big players should have some obligations. Smaller players in the broad, let it rip and see what happens. So what obligations should the big players have? New media players, Google, or old players, television and radio stations? We came up, after a lot of consultation around the country, with three notions that Australians really cared about. Diversity of voice, that the freedom of any player should not be such that they could crowd out a diversity of voice, a diversity of owners, a diversity of enterprises. Secondly, that there needs to be some protection from harm of some parts of the user audience community. Classification, children's rules, laws about sex and children in content, and so on. And thirdly, that there needed to be something to keep people focused on accuracy and fairness and ethical behaviour in journalism. Now, they're the only three areas that Australians, the thousands of Australians we spoke to, really cared about. But those they really cared about, and they cared about that they should apply to the big brands, the big trusted brands that they've always believed in and which are now going through these changes. And so that was the framework of our analysis. And I think there are some concepts there that sooner or later, and one of the things about doing these government reports is you really are doing them, hopefully, for the future, where a bureaucrat puts it into the bottom drawer when a new government comes in, but slowly over time pulls it out and has a look at it, and occasionally, and this has happened a bit already, takes an idea out of the report and puts it up, even as their own idea, and says, hey, Minister, what about this? So we're hopeful that those ideas will be important. The other thing we did was look in that third area of journalism at the Finkelstein proposals. We thought they were not right. We thought the notion of putting obligations to journalistic activity on big and small players went against our principle of regulate the big, powerful players. And secondly, we thought that the notion of having another separate regulator to regulate from a government perspective journalism was not right, and that there needed to be a much more deregulatory, self-regulatory approach. And so we endorsed the notion that the press is a great bulwark against rogue government, but there also needs to be an effective system to protect the citizens against rogue press. And what we came up was a system which had an industry-led regulatory framework where the only intersection really with government was that large organisations who do journalism had to be a member of an organisation that had this kind of characteristic, A, B and C. It was dinkum, it had sanctions against organisations that breached its own rules, and that it provided an effective way of following up complaints from the public. And if an organisation got a tick from the framework as an organisation that did those things, then government should get out of the way and let it operate. Now, that kind of recognition of what is essentially a self-run regulatory organisation is complex and difficult both here, and if you follow the British press environment there too, where is this minimal intersection between government and the industry? How do you do it so that it doesn't bring the quite justified fear of government interference in what is a free press? Having said that, I can say just two things to finish. I spent a total of 10 years at the Australian Broadcasting Authority and the Australian Communications and Media Authority, spending a lot of time looking at breaches of the codes that electronic journalists have, which is a co-regulatory code between government and the industry, and that seemed to work reasonably well. However, I think it was less than optimal because not enough journalistic expertise was available in the deciding about whether codes had been breached or not. Better left to a professional group with more insight into the industry. But I have to say, I had the same concerns about the current Press Council, where members can leave or not leave as they wish, where at the end of the day the members always have the right to decide whether any new code or new development occurs, and where there seems to be on recent form a fair bit of tension and difficulty between one or some of the members and the current board. Now that's not good regulation either, and when newspapers argue that that's perfectly reasonable and beyond criticism, they would not apply that kind of analysis when there is a press criticism of some conflict of interest in business or in other areas. So our solution was a third kind of solution I've broadly outlined, and I think all of those things help content, media content and journalism get better, and as a member of that review, we hope and think that it's those ideas are sitting there, sleeping, waiting to be rediscovered at some point, and we hope they are. Thanks.
Thank you, Malcolm. So lots of ideas, lots of positions, lots of challenges right now. Can I come back to you, Paul, to start with? There's a question that's emerged. What's the big picture for this government in terms of media policy and media reform? We've heard about some inconsistency. We've heard concerns about what you're doing with amendments to national security legislation, concerns that proposed changes in media ownership may not have a larger context. What is that vision for where this sector's going?
Well, I think the vision very much picks up on a lot of the themes that Malcolm was talking about, Malcolm Long, and some of the things that I mentioned in my opening remarks, namely the fundamental transformation that is occurring and what's the right regulatory response so as to maximise the capacity of both existing industry players and new players, new entrants of all kinds of sizes, to contribute to the outcome that we all want, which is a diversity of voices, vigorous flow of news, of comment, all of which is so important in terms of underpinning the operation of a liberal democracy. So one of the key themes for us, as I mentioned, is let's identify areas where existing regulation is no longer fit for purpose. Let's also be very alert to regulation which inadvertently makes a choice between new entrants using new technologies and incumbents. In other words, to the extent that you leave stuff there, you are, in a sense, burdening incumbents with restrictions that new entrants don't face. And there's plenty of examples of that, content requirements and so on, which, a Netflix or any other operator providing video over the internet doesn't face, but that both subscription and free-to-air TV face. So we've certainly articulated an appetite for reducing the regulatory burden on the sector, and underpinning that is some of those issues about, well, if you simply do nothing, you are leaving... you've got a set of arrangements in place which have been in place for a long time when an industry is the drivers of it are changing very rapidly. At the same time, we are very conscious, I mean, Jason referred in a wry fashion to the challenges that these issues have faced successive governments, and so we have been quite specific in saying we're looking for a consensus amongst industry stakeholders. So, an appetite to make some of these changes, but we are looking for a consensus because there's not much point in starting out on a journey if you don't think you're going to be able to finish it. So, a very clear theme there about understanding those underlying structural drivers.
Thanks. So, Jason and Scott, just quickly, Paul's talked a lot about getting the environment right, the sort of broader framework, and how that can promote diversity and innovation and plurality. What would you do that he's not doing, especially around this question of supporting journalism, independent journalism, and its diversity and vitality and sustainability in this country?
Do you want to kick off?
Jason first, perhaps.
Maybe properly fund the ABC and the SBS.
Okay, that's
start.
Number one.
Okay.
Number two.
Number one. Well, Malcolm was here, I think, 3 years ago, and he was talking about DGR status for not-for-profit media agencies. Uh-huh. I'm not sure what the government's policy is on that. That might be something to quiz Paul about.
Can I quiz you about it? What do you think?
Well, I think I'm not in favour of that. I think you need to fund national public broadcasting. That's okay. The way to do that and do that properly. The government is looking at making changes to the law for crowdfunding, as that specifically applies to the startup industry, but there might be arguments there that media agencies could take advantage of that. It's something to pose for consideration. Our job as parliamentarians is to assess proposals that are brought forward by the government and assess them on their merits on a case-by-case basis. Some of the things that the government has flagged were flagged in the convergence review. You expect to see them come forward. Things like the changes to the reach rule, we've got an inherent sympathy for because it was something that we proposed. Scott will make the point, I'm sure, about the importance of local content being protected in regional areas, and he's right to point that out. But we'll wait and see what the government does there. In relation to other parts of that reform proposal, I think it's important to make the point when it comes to media ownership that the internet has changed things, that is correct, but it hasn't necessarily transformed the landscape. And the discussion paper the government put out a couple of months ago made the point that the top five news websites are all owned by traditional media outlets, and eight of the top 10 are. So the big organisations which provide media through traditional sources own the websites that are providing media information or news information to people through news sources as well.
So diversity and plurality still a major issue. Mm. Scott, some quick remarks from you?
I mean, staying the hell away from public broadcasting, I think we've seen both political attacks and also budget attacks, and those two things leveraged together in quite a nasty way and quite unusually so in the Australian political context, at least in my recent experience of this stuff. Guaranteed spectrum for community broadcasters. I think it's just profoundly mean-spirited to propose to take the community TV stations offline at the end of next year. Unnecessary. And I actually don't understand what's driving that. Maybe Paul can let us know. But just telling them to go off and play on YouTube, I think if you told that to Seven West, they'd explode. So I don't think it's particularly sensible to do that to the community broadcasters. And I think this consensus building, I'd like to unpack what that means. Does that just mean wait until you've got the big incumbent broadcast and print organisations all on the same page and then blast something through Parliament? What it sounds like. Or is New Matilda at the table and are the Guardian there and are little startups there? Let's have that conversation in public. Otherwise, what we're going to do is wait until there's agreement amongst the big incumbents that we can lift. Probably it's the 2 out of 3 rule that protects us from even further consolidation. And once all the commercial players have lined up on that, we'll see a bill and it'll be blasted through. That's not what I call consensus. If this is actually about protecting diversity, such as the ethnic and gender diversity that you see up here on the stage this morning, then invite more players into the conversation, I guess, would be my short take.
Thank
that
you,
was
Scott.
Cheeky, wasn't it?
Well, Julian, can I just pick up on the point about community TV? Scott asked, well, look, what's the rationale for that? And the rationale is essentially about the use of spectrum. So at the moment, the so-called 6-channel, the 7 megahertz of digital spectrum, is being used by community TV in the 5 capital cities, not anywhere else, but in the 5 capital cities. If you look at the numbers, the average number of people viewing, it's about 2,000 people in Melbourne, 6,000 people nationally. So these are very, very small numbers. And as Malcolm has said, as Malcolm Turnbull, the Minister, has said, the thinking behind moving community TV onto the internet is that we believe that's simply a better medium to have community television reaching larger numbers of people. Also, of course, once operating in that format, it won't be subject to some of the restrictions that apply under the Broadcasting Services Act in terms of sponsorship and so on. But essentially, it's driven by two considerations. One, how can you better reach people who are looking for an alternative to the commercial TV providers? And secondly, how do you make better use of that 7 megahertz of spectrum? Spectrum is such a vital asset. The other point I just quickly make is no change to the arrangements there for radio. And the picture in terms of community radio, obviously a pretty vibrant sort of landscape.
Of course. Thank you, Paul. So in the interests of diversity and plurality, it's obviously time we opened this discussion up. And so I'm inviting your questions. Can I emphasise that word, questions? Please make them brief, make them clear, and we'll try to get as many in as possible. Thank you.
The question I have is the intersection between Scott and Paul. The lack of protection for whistleblowers when revealed that we have no Bill of Rights as well, which everybody knows but have been forgotten, means that we have a real tension between the government's professed intent to remove regulation and providing perhaps the most severe, long-lasting shutdown of not just journalists, but every individual in the room acting as a journalist with retrospective area. I'd like to understand how this is to be reconciled in the government's coherent program.
I couldn't have put that better. Over to you, Paul.
Well, look, let's take the metadata issue, for example, because there's been a lot of commentary about that. Some of the commentary doesn't seem to recognise the fact that under the Telecommunications Intercept and Access Act of 1979, so an act that's been around for a long time, there's an existing legal framework under which the agencies, so that's Australian Federal Police, State Police, security agencies such as ASIO,
Centrelink,
and some
Post,
others, can get access to metadata. Now, just to be clear, metadata is not the content of a conversation. So in a telecommunications context, it's, for example, the number and location of the A party, and if to use the telco industry jargon, and if it's on a mobile network, for example, which base station you're connected to, number and location of the B party, duration of the call, that kind of information. In the case of an internet browsing session, it's specifically the originating IP address. Now, one of the points here is that a lot of the telcos will... The IP address will get allocated for the period of the browsing session. In some cases, it can change several times during the browsing session. And so the metadata requirement is that the where a stored communications request is provided, that the carriage service provider provides the identity of the subscriber that maps to that IP address, because the IP address is changing constantly. I want to make it very clear, this does not cover content, doesn't cover the content of the conversation or the browsing session, doesn't cover the destination IP address, which is a very different thing. But I do, I guess the fundamental point I want to make there is that the legal capacity for agencies to get access to that information upon the provision of a stored communication request in accordance with the provisions of the Telecommunications Intercept and Access Act has been there for a long time. The specific change that's proposed here is to increase the requirement on the telcos and the ISPs as to how long they store that metadata. Because today the legal position is that the carriers and the ISPs will store that information for their own business purposes. So the classic example is you store the records of the call, A party, B party, time, etc., because that's an input into your billing system. You run that through and then generate bills. And so they'll have their own, the carriers and the ISPs will have their own business requirements and business processes for how long they store that information. What is proposed to be changed in the legislation is to impose a requirement as to how long the information must be stored, such that if a stored communication request is then issued, then it can be applied in the normal way.
Can I just really quickly jump in?
Yes, just quickly.
I just ask, you've managed to make saturation real-time surveillance sound kind of harmless and anodyne just then, which is quite a feat. It's quite impressive. All I would ask is that you help us shout this thing from the rooftop so it doesn't pass into law. The existing system is broken. There are 340,000 of these warrantless access requests being made on every man, woman, child, every device in the country already without a warrant, and that for me is a very significant problem. When you consider that, you know, let's just presume most people in the room carrying a handset around, you can track the location of these things to within a few metres everywhere you take it. That is content. When you overlay that with all your social networks, and I get that the government doesn't want browsing history at the moment, they'll come back for that later. It's 2 years now, they'll come back for 5 years later. This whole boiling frog thing, I just feel like the temperature's just got a little too hot. Please help us prevent this thing from passing into law. It's going to be damn difficult to take off the statute books once it's there. And if you want the technical details, IINet published their submission, their response to the government's paper, which hasn't been put into the public domain yet, so we haven't seen it. I'd just encourage you, if you want to know how this is actually proposed to work in practice, please just have a quick look at that submission, and if it freaks you out, then do what you can before it passes into law rather than after.
Thanks, Scott. Other questions?
Hi, I'd just like to clarify your description of metadata and get your view about whether it would include essentially a journalist's phone book of all their sources.
Well, there's one other point I should make about metadata, which is a point that Minister Turnbull has made repeatedly. So metadata is a term that defines a concept. What we obviously need to do is define with statutory precision what will be subject to the requirements on the telcos and the ISPs to retain the data. So that is work that's going on right now in close consultation with industry participants, the telcos, including IINet and others. So I can't go through category by category and say this is in, this is out, because that work is being done at the moment.
The AG's department's been at this for 6 years and they still don't have a definition of metadata. That's going to tell you something.
But Paul did a better job than George Brandis did just then.
He did. Actually, that's true. Paul actually has used the internet.
Okay.
Yep. A question on Mr. Long's reference to rogue journalism in Australia. Apart from the usual criticisms of the tabloid press, are there examples any of the panel can cite on rogue journalism in this country?
I use rogue journalism for theatrical effect, and it's had that effect. Look, I'll answer that in a way which may seem not to the point, but I think you'll see it is. And it's about the ABC, but it brings up the other issue. When radio was invented and countries around the world had to decide how they structured it in the community, there was two fundamental different views of what should be done. The Americans said, oh my God, we've got this powerful new medium, incredibly powerful new medium. We mustn't put it in the hands of government. Let's put it into the marketplace and let it run commercially. And we got the American system of broadcasting. The British said, oh my God, we've got this incredibly powerful new system of communications. We mustn't put it in the hands of the media barons, Lord Northcliffe and the others, who were very powerful in the 1920s. Those of you who have the history will know. We better keep it in government. In Australia, in our usual style, we're a little bit later than everyone else, a couple of years. And we said, the Americans are protecting everyone against government. The British are protecting everyone against the media barons. Bugger it. Why don't we do both? And it was the only time, apart from a short period, which Paul would be aware of in the 90s in telecoms legislation, it was the only time where Australia led the world in terms of media wisdom in policy. Because, of course, we did get both. The Americans in the 60s, the Carnegie Commission and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, did produce a kind of public broadcasting system, which in America now is quite strong and healthy. And, of course, the British and the Europeans discovered commercial broadcasting rather than just having the government constantly telling you what to do. The point of it is that the notion with that our press, and I mean our press rather than our media, constantly pushes that the only bulwark we've got against bad things, we being citizens, is the press's defence of our interests against government, and that is the fundamental basis of all the arguments against regulation of the press, is never balanced, as we have done systemically through having a national and commercial sector in media, in electronic media, by the equally valid notion is that private media media is powerful and can be not just rogue but systemically damaging, and that having a balance between private media and public media is really, really important, whatever the budget bun fights, and I've been through many of them, may be between governments and over time. And I think that's my answer to your question. The notion that way back at the beginning, we realised that having an unbridled, mogul-driven press was as dangerous as having a press that was in the pocket of government. And we got a good result, and we need to keep it.
This is for Paul again, just on metadata. I'm just wondering, what's the point in collecting it if, when you analyse it without content, it leaves so much room for misinterpretation? Because Scott's mentioned that it'll eventually come, that you'll come for content and whatnot. So I don't understand what's the point in starting this and keeping it for 2 years if whoever decides to analyse it's like it does, like you, they see where you go, what you like, who you're talking to and whatnot, but like what is the point of it?
Well, if you talk to the police and the security agencies, the sort of examples that they give, and they've certainly said this publicly, is that it's a very useful investigative tool and has been for many years that it's been used. For example, by being able to establish that a group of people who are under investigation, you know, are in a relationship with each other, the fact that they're in regular contact with each other. So it's that kind of purpose for which it's used. Again, bear in mind, there has to be a stored communication request issued to the telcos or the ISPs before that information is provided.
Thanks.
This is another question for Paul as well. If the media companies can't agree on ownership, will the government do nothing? And if the answer is no, what other sectors in Australia get to write their own laws?
Mining industry.
Question for Paul.
Well, essentially what we've said is we are going through a period of seeking consensus, but we are saying to stakeholders we do need to see consensus before we can advance. And so the intention very clearly is to say, look, government is looking to industry to tell us what are the changes that you think are necessary to help deal with the different context of the industry, the different technological, the different industry drivers, the different economic drivers, and so that's the basic principle we've set out. We are looking for some consensus amongst stakeholders.
Paul, can I just ask you quickly, I mean, how likely do you think consensus is?
Well, it's difficult to predict the future, but clearly there's a lot of people, a lot of stakeholders are saying there are significant aspects of the regulatory framework that need to be updated, need to be refreshed, need to be removed. I mean, again, I make the point, we come at this with a bias that says, where is there a capacity to remove regulation? And we've already introduced some significant removal and reduction of regulation as it affects the media sector and other aspects of the communications portfolio. In the first repeal day earlier this year, there was legislation in a number of areas, reducing reporting requirements, reducing the regulatory burden. We've got another repeal day coming up later this year as part of the government's policy of having 2 days a year dedicated to removing regulation rather than adding to regulation. And there will be additional measures designed to reduce the regulatory burden in both telecommunications and the broadcasting and media parts of the communications portfolio. So there's a general bias from government towards from the Abbott government towards a reduction in regulation. We've got a government-wide target to achieve a reduction savings of $1 billion a year across government in terms of the burden of regulation. And in the communications portfolio, we're looking to do that as well. But we are saying to industry stakeholders, we are looking for consensus in some of the in the key areas.
I am sorry, we have run out of time for this discussion. Time for me to thank a few people, you especially, the audience here, for all your questions and close attention to our panellists this morning. I'd like to thank also the Wheeler Centre and the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne and Swinburne University, all institutions which I think are doing an extraordinary job in sustaining the sort of conversation that we've been part of today and which is so necessary for really good policy development and debate in this area and many others. But especially I'd like to thank our panellists. So thank you very much.